If you're trying to get pregnant, or you are pregnant, and you feel a little bit overwhelmed by all you need to know, then this is the right podcast for you. Welcome to the show. I'm Bridget Maloney.
And I'm obstetrician Dr. Patrick Maloney. And this is The Kick, your expert-led podcast that delivers the essentials of growing a baby. Make sure you head to our website, growmybaby.com.au, to get some awesome free tools like our Pregnancy Knowledge Checker to help you feel like you got this.
Today we are speaking with Priyanka Saha. She's the founder of the Lily Kelvert Fund, the Instagram account The Lily Flower, and storytelling platform The Murmuring of 10 Million. She's a lawyer and runs a cyber security company. She also advocates for patient-centric healthcare through Lily's charity and as a board member to a regional Victorian health service. Priyanka's firstborn daughter, Lily, died when she was 10 months old from an incurable brain condition known as Miller-Dieker syndrome. Not long after Lily's funeral, Priyanka found out she was pregnant with her rainbow baby, Jasper. In this podcast, she shares her story to help anyone trying to navigate the highs and the lows, the grief and the joy, and the anxieties that can exist during conception, pregnancy, and parenting your rainbow baby. So Priyanka, thank you for joining us. It's very generous. It's exactly what I said in our opening spiel about what you mean for people who have experienced baby loss. And I've listened to a few of the things that you've said recently, and one that really resonated with me was that you've said that there's no hierarchy on grief. Could you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, look, the hierarchy on grief is a big one because, you know, I have had some really bad losses, you know, starting with an ectopic pregnancy. For me, that was the worst thing at that time that had ever happened to me. But, you know, a year later, I went on to receive the diagnosis that my baby was going to die and that if she lived, she would have, you know, severe developmental delays. So that was a much worse, in a way, kind of loss to the ectopic loss. And I often get people saying to me, oh, this has happened to me, but it's nowhere near as bad as what you went through. Because I think people put a hierarchy on grief. So they say, oh, an ectopic is bad or a miscarriage is bad, but it's not as bad as a stillbirth or it's not as bad as losing a living child. But what I really passionately feel is that your loss is your loss, and it is the worst thing that's ever happened to you. So for me, when I had an ectopic pregnancy loss, it was horrendous and I grieved and I felt terribly sad about it. And for me, that was, you know, as bad as it could get. So just because there's somebody else who you think has had it worse, it doesn't make your loss any less valid or any less real than it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Every day, 851 babies are born in Australia. Now, we don't have 2021 figures yet because the census isn't in, but six babies of that number are stillborn and two die within 28 days of birth, and we call this a neonatal death. So the idea of pregnancy loss stems really from miscarriage right up to, you know, a neonatal death, and that's what we're going to be talking about today when we're planning for our rainbow baby. So let's talk about that term. What do you think the best definition of a rainbow baby is?
Look, it's a term that people do feel quite strongly about. Some people love it, some hate it. For me, it's a little bit bittersweet because Lily was my rainbow baby and then she died. So Jasper, who came after Lily, we called him our sunshine boy because for us it felt like he brought sort of sunshine back into our life again. And I think one of the reasons that rainbows sometimes can be a bit fraught is that people are worried that this happy news can't, that people will perceive that the happy news will cancel out their grief. But if you think about the idea of a rainbow, it's, you know, sunlight shining through water to create a rainbow. And for me, that means allowing the happiness and the sadness that you'll always feel, that will always be there, to sit alongside one another. And it can exist together. You know, you don't have to cancel out the grief just because you have a new joy. And equally, you know, having sadness doesn't mean that you can't be happy. I think for me, recognizing that happiness and sadness can sit alongside each other and gratitude and grief can sit together is almost like the secret to life. And when you can accept that those two feelings can be there and peacefully coexist within you, it's kind of a really big stepping stone to healing, for want of a better word.
Just existing as well. Like, I mean, I think we're pretty naive to think that we can have one without the other. I don't think that's sustainable. And life we live is full of different episodes that can either be grief or joy.
That's right. And it's okay to feel both. I think modern society often pushes this idea that we should be looking for happiness all the time and that happiness will equal contentment. But happiness is often quite a fleeting feeling. You can have a life that's rich and filled with joy and good things, but also acknowledge that bad things might happen to you. And actually, the perspective that you get from being aware of the world and all of the different things that can happen can make your life even richer, I think.
My 84-year-old mum calls that being at peace. And so you're at peace with either the joy or the grief or whatever. You're not in that perpetual search for happiness, but you just feel at peace with that.
And yeah, that's exactly it. That's very wise. I love that.
She's a wise old lady now, 84. I can't believe she's 84, honestly. All right, so we've talked about the term rainbow baby, but before we go on to planning for Jasper's birth, and I hope that this podcast is full of hope, but I really want to talk about Lily. And so I thought we might start with, you know, not just her sort of chronological story, but I'd love to hear whether you could share some of the things that you loved about Lily and what your lovely, best, fondest memories of Lily are.
Of course, I love talking about Lily. She's my beautiful firstborn baby girl. And Lily kind of defied the odds from the very beginning. She was born with this catastrophic brain condition. And we were told that, you know, she might not survive birth. She might not survive that night. She might live for a week. She might live for 2 years. It was all very scary and unknown. And that if she did live longer than that first week, she wouldn't be able to do anything, really. She wouldn't be able to feed. And Lily just, you know, even right from being born, she was born, she had her eyes open immediately after birth and she just looked into our eyes for what felt like hours. And she was able to feed. So immediately she suckled from a, you know, a little dropper syringe. And then one of the nurses gave her a bottle and she actually could drink the bottle. And the next day, to everyone's surprise, she began to breastfeed.
Oh, wow.
So she was just incredible. And I think, you know, there were so many moments in Lily's short life that defied the odds like that. We had 5 nights in the hospital and then we went home like a normal family. We made a plan with a lot of support from our healthcare team that we wanted Lily's life to be as least medicalized as it could safely be for her. So she would be kept, you know, as comfortable as she could be, but that we would prioritize her quality of life. And so we were able to go home. She traveled all around Australia. She went, had her first swim at Noosa and came to Tassie several times where our family is. She went to Bondi. She went to New Zealand with us and we took her everywhere. And in her little life, she only spent 1 day in hospital. That was when her seizures first began. And after that, we were able to take her home. And we advocated strongly for that, but we were really well supported to do it. And we had hospital in the home that would come and we were connected with the local hospice, very special kids. But yeah, I just have wonderful memories of holding Lily, of her experiencing music. It's her favourite thing and we do a lot of work with the Lily Calvert Fund and sharing music therapy to others. Beautiful memories. And even though she only lived for 10 months and 15 days, it was an entire lifetime. It was her entire lifetime and it felt a lot longer than just 10 short months.
You know, it's just an amazing story that you tell and that's where you do bring that joy in. I've seen so many lovely photos on your Instagram of Lily and her smile and I think, you know, she has a special warmth and I think connection, which is probably what people are seeking as well. You know, that's why your Instagram is so successful and popular is because people can see that she has a special place in your heart and you've shared that with others as well. So
yeah, and I think if someone has a really bad diagnosis, a really serious diagnosis, it can be so terrifying and scary. And the idea that you have in your head of what it's going to look like can be very different from reality. And one of the things that I hope to share is that we are a normal family, that Lily looked normal. Like, you know, often it's quite outdated, the information you get handed. So you might get pamphlets from the 80s or the 90s with, you know, really, they just, the photos are bad, you know, so it looks terrifying and you feel like your life is going to, I don't know, somehow be teleported back in time and everything's going to be really daggy and dusty and awful. So we just want to show that there are lots of normal families out there that have plans that change and things that go differently, but, you know, you can still have a beautiful life with that and there can still be hope there.
So when in Lily's life did you think that you could have another baby?
So we had been told that Lily might live for 2 years minimum and potentially longer. So we had this idea, she loved other children, that it would be really nice for her to experience having a sibling. She was about 9, 10, well, she died when she was 10 months. So I started to think about it. Together we started to think about it when she was about 9 months old and what that would look like and what I needed to do. So we, you know, started taking the prenatal vitamins, started doing acupuncture, which was something that was really helpful for me. And then we didn't think that we would be having another baby for a while. It was more like a long-term plan to get our heads in the game. And I actually found out that I was pregnant with Jasper, sadly, the week after Lily died, a very difficult time.
Yeah, I could imagine. A happy time, but again, it's back to that grief and joy. Like, sometimes we expect the getting pregnant journey to be a lot longer sometimes and you think, oh, well, I've got to have this planning time. And there we have it, like a month.
That's right. And particularly because I have only one fallopian tube, having had one removed at the ectopic, I, you know, I was like, oh, it's going to be a little bit harder. We knew that it wasn't going to be, you know, really, really difficult because Lily's, falling pregnant with Lily wasn't that hard either. But I thought, you know, it'll take a bit of time. So finding out that I was pregnant with Jasper, it was very difficult. And in many respects, I often get asked, how did you, you know, get ready for pregnancy after loss and to try again? And in that phase, there wasn't a lot of planning or getting ready for it. It was more like a slap to the face. And it wasn't easy. And I had some support. I had a psychologist that I saw regularly, that we saw together as well. And we had a beautiful counsellor. So we were referred to Very Special Kids, which is a Victorian paediatric palliative care hospice. And one of the incredible services that they provide is free counselling forever if you want it. So you get a family support person and a counsellor and they can be there as much as you need them. So I don't, you know, have that person now, but if I wanted to get back into the system, rather than having to go back and get a referral and, you know, there's so much backlog, it's literally just emailing Very Special Kids, getting back on the counselling list and someone will be allocated back to me. So,
oh my gosh, that's an incredible service. And for that to be free.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So you talked about a psychologist. Was that somebody who was a postnatal, prenatal specialist?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes. And so we went to see her together for a few sessions after Lily died. And then I saw her for a while after that until, I think I saw her up until Jasper was born, just kind of preparing and exploring and creating good strategies and kind of helping me to pop some of the ideas that I had, you know, that needed testing. I found it really, really useful and I really encourage people to get that support if they're having, you know, a pregnancy after loss.
We encourage people even just through a pregnancy where there's no grief to deal with. We love everybody to see a pre and postnatal psychologist or social worker, someone who you can just sort of really work out some of the issues. But obviously for you, it was vital. And did you see any other specialists before or during your pregnancy with Jasper?
So I did the acupuncture, which was really helpful for me because it gave me kind of a space to just be. Like, you know, acupuncture, once you get the needles in you, then you usually have to lie in a room for 45 minutes. I think people underestimate the value of being in a room with no technology. You can't scroll on your phone and you just sit inside, you lie in silence. And I think it's really an important part. I know it's probably not, you know, I don't really understand the intricacies of acupuncture, but that for me was really important. We also did some genetic screening testing. So when Lily was diagnosed with Miller-Dieker syndrome, the genetics teams had tested to see if we were carriers of that, and we weren't. So her condition was just a completely random thing that happened. But I discovered when I was pregnant with Jasper that I thought they'd done larger screening and that hadn't been done. So we went into a bit of a panic mode. I just needed to know that I wasn't a carrier of something, even if it wasn't related to Lily's condition. And I really strongly encourage everyone to explore screening for themselves and their partner, because I think knowledge is power. And if you know that you or your partner are a carrier of something, then you can plan accordingly. And yeah, I think it's something that everyone should be offered. We did I wanted to find the screening tests that would test for as much as possible. So I know a lot of people do tests. There's some new ones coming on. The Eugene Labs do some good ones. We did the Council Foresight carrier testing, which tested for loads of different things, and I think our blood was sent to America, and it came back all clear. So that gave me some peace of mind. But because what had happened to Lily happened at 36 weeks with, you know, a very normal pregnancy, I'd done the NIPT testing, nothing had shown. I'd had, you know, a clear 12-week scan and a clear 20-week scan. The brain doesn't start to develop until after 20 weeks. So you really can't see if there's an abnormality there unless you're doing post-20-week scans, and most people aren't doing them in ultrasound conditions. So the ultrasound that my OB had in her office wasn't strong enough to pick up on any issues there. So I was very paranoid about that. And I just did a lot of extra ultrasounds with a fetal medicine specialist as well. And we also did a CVS at 12 weeks. And that was really for peace of mind. I needed to know early if there was going to be something wrong, because a diagnosis at 36 weeks is horrendous. I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy, on anybody's worst enemy.
I know. I think at 36 weeks, you think that check is just basically a little peek at your baby just before they're born. From an obstetrician's point of view, it's a very important check, because you're looking at birth weight and you're looking at the fluid around the baby. And we've got a very fancy ultrasound at our clinic, and we definitely offer that for somebody that is needing the reassurance during their pregnancy, and particularly if they've had a baby loss. Like, that's just something that you can reassure your patient with whenever. We call it a sneaky peek. You just want to see the heartbeat. You just want to know
that's
that it's,
it.
Yeah.
And I think for a lot of people who've had a loss, it will be just about checking that the heartbeat was there. In my situation, it was, I wanted to know that the brain was developing, and I wanted to know so many things. So I was, really well supported by my doctors to do that. And, you know, I needed to have a fetal medicine specialist doing every single one of them so that they could tell me if there was something wrong and I didn't have to go to that special room, the bad room.
Yeah, the bad room. Yeah. No more bad news from that bad room.
Oh, and it's awful. I recently had a very early miscarriage. So we're in the process of trying again after loss. And it was very early and very sad, but we were in Queensland at the time, so I didn't have my usual team, my rock star team that I had. And so we did have to go into that little room. We went to an ultrasound, the technician or, you know, the sonographer confirmed what had happened. And then we went into that little room and we just felt like the walls were closing in. I was like, we promised we'd never be stuck in one of these rooms again. And here we are. So,
God, that is such good sort of feedback. Like, why can't they be open and airy? And
the bad room, it's awful. There are always no windows in there. It's just not, it's not a fun place to be.
Now, I just want to pick up on a point you were making about pre-pregnancy genetic screening. So, listeners, go back to episode 3, What I Wish Every Woman Knew Before Becoming Pregnant, and Dr. Pat will talk about the pre-pregnancy genetic screening that you can do for very common genes that are commonly in our population, such as cystic fibrosis, spinal muscular atrophy, and fragile X syndrome. So that's something that we really recommend people have before getting pregnant. For anyone wanting to extend their knowledge and bring some calm and confidence into growing your baby, we invite you to our free masterclass. In this hour of power, we talk about the most common mistakes we all make when we are growing a baby, and why these mistakes can cause unnecessary overwhelm. In our clinic, we have helped thousands of women have their babies, and we want to share the knowledge with you that we've gained so you can feel supported, reassured, calm, and confident. If this is you, in this episode link in Spotify or iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts, you'll find a link to the masterclass. Jump on it and choose a time that suits you. If you can't find the link, send us an email at info@growmybaby.com.au or as a DM in Instagram. We are here to help you level up your knowledge. Now back to the show.
You're listening to The Kick with Dr. Pat and Bridget.
Hi everyone. Well, we've got a milestone coming up and we want to celebrate it with you, our listeners. May 7th, we're going to launch our 100th episode of The Kick. And guess what? We couldn't have done it without our listeners. To celebrate, we are asking for you to tell us your biggest tips about getting pregnant, being pregnant, becoming a mother, birth, anything that you think future listeners might benefit from. And we want 100 voices. As a gift to you for adding your voice, we will give everyone a whopping 50% discount to any of our programs. You can use this yourself or gift it to a friend. To add your voice, go to our website, growmybaby.com.au. We will then put a selection of the voices together for our 100th episode. That sounds like fun, doesn't it? So the website again is growmybaby.com.au. We are so excited to hear all your biggest tips for future mamas just like you.
Also, while you're just recommending people go back to previous episodes, last night I listened to the ectopic pregnancy episode. And I just want to say that if you don't know what an ectopic pregnancy is, or you're planning a pregnancy, I strongly recommend people listen to it. I wish I'd listened to it in 2015 because I did all the things that you shouldn't do. I didn't go to the emergency. I went to a walk-in GP clinic with no continuity of care. It wasn't picked up on, ruptured, I was bleeding internally, all these things that if I had listened to that podcast, I would have gone straight to an emergency department and things could have, you know, been less traumatic than they were. So it's a really useful episode for people to listen to.
Oh, thanks for that, Priyanka. I know, you know, we do cover some really tough topics. And before you and I started recording, we were saying that, you know, some of the tougher topics, we have less listens and you just don't know what you don't know. So we always encourage people to listen to all of them, like even the tough topics, such as our part one, part two about when a baby dies and why a baby dies. We all want positive outcomes, obviously. We just don't know how our pregnancy is going to go. And I think you're an example of that and how you've managed that from there. You just really have to have a massive pat on your back. You've done such an amazing job. So what were the milestone appointments with your doctor that you found the most stressful? And obviously that's different for everybody, but what were the ones that you were just, you know, panic-stricken over?
So for Jasper's pregnancy, it was almost everything, but getting that all clear at 12 weeks was really important for me. And that included doing that additional testing, the CVS testing, which would look at chromosomal issues. So getting that was the hardest, waiting for it. The procedure itself, and, you know, I know that it won't be applicable for many people, but the procedure itself was actually pretty straightforward and nowhere near as scary as I thought it would be. But then just waiting to get those results back. Once I got that clarity that we'd been screened for genetic issues and that it had passed the anatomy scan, I was able to breathe a sigh of relief and actually start to believe that there might be a baby. It was almost like I had to anchor to the next appointment. So I would get that peace of mind for a few weeks and then it would start to build. And sometimes in those few weeks before the next appointment, I would call and say, I've just got to come in for an ultrasound. We need to check that everything's okay. And they're like, okay, come in. We called them my mental health checks mostly. Then for me, again, it was major anatomy issue. Like I just wanted to make sure everything was developing. You know, we missed that with Lily's. And so post 20 weeks was important for me to see the baby's brain development on the ultrasound as well. I mean, I could have gone deeper. I could have gone for a fetal MRI, but even I knew that once we were at that stage, I was like, no, it's okay, Priyanka, we can actually chill out now. But, you know, pregnancy after loss, I say it's like a marathon because you get a bit of peace of mind and then you have this little voice in your head that freaks you out again and then you get a bit more peace of mind and it's anxious every moment is anxious. And, you know, it really wasn't until Jasper was in my arms and my obstetrician was saying he's breathing, he's alive, and I was holding him that I believed I was going to have a living child.
Oh, my gosh. We know that if, say, for your case, Lily was born with vaginal birth and Jasper as well. But for those that are listening that perhaps had a problem at birth and that's why their baby died, quite often they're offered a cesarean from the get-go. And it's about that anxiety around the birth that helps them to feel like they just want a healthy, live baby, no matter how that birth took place. How did you feel going into the birth with Jasper?
I was incredibly anxious. So 36 weeks was when Lily was sort of, we knew something was wrong. 37 was when we had a more definitive diagnosis. And around that time, I just started to freak out. So we did the 36-week ultrasound and, you know, we passed it with flying colours. On the one hand, I was aware that this is how a pregnancy should be and this is what it is like for most people. You know, most people will have a very normal pregnancy and they won't have any of these concerns. By the time I was at 37 weeks, I had made a plan with my OB that I would be induced. I didn't feel that I needed to go through a cesarean, and perhaps because the trauma wasn't the actual birth, it was a bit before the birth.
And you had a successful vaginal birth. Like that's a great start.
Yeah. And with Lily, we had, you know, a few weeks where they were terrible weeks before she was born, but it gave us time to kind of plan, and we explored the idea of allowing her to come naturally. That helped to shape the way her life went, you know, with kind of taking a least medicalized approach. With Jasper, I needed it to be clinical. I needed heart rate monitors. I was convinced that his heart rate was wrong. I had them checking it all the time because it was so good. And I had an epidural very early on, so I had a few contractions, but I was like, I need to have my head in the game. So I went in, I was induced, I had the epidural. I needed it to be kind of the opposite of natural. And then he was born, and I think I was saying, like, is he breathing? Is he breathing? Is he breathing? And I just remember my OB looking at me and saying, he is breathing. He is alive, and giving him to me. And yeah, it was not easy. But when I look back on it, it was the right birth for me. And potentially, you know, if I'm lucky enough to have another baby, I think it will probably be very similar to that, because that's what I needed and that's what made me feel safe. And yeah, I need all the professionals around.
And that's the definition of a mother-led birth. So whatever it is that mother needs, then we should be able to support her to get to that safe delivery. If it's a medicalized delivery, you know, so be it.
And I think there's a lot of glamorizing natural births that can be really harmful and make women feel a lot of shame if they don't do that. And so if anyone's listening, I just think it's really important to understand that there are lots of different ways to birth, and the way that makes you feel the safest and the most supported is the best way.
Yeah, brilliantly said. I know that lots of partners listen to The Kick. What did your husband need before and during your pregnancy with Jasper? Often it's hard to talk on their behalf, but what did you see worked for him?
So he was equally as anxious as me. And after Lily died and I first found out I was pregnant, we both just couldn't even get our heads in the space that, you know, this was happening. So it was a week after the funeral, we called my obstetrician and said, we're thinking about flying to Japan. Can we do that? Because of the risk of ectopic, at what point do I have to have an early ultrasound? And, you know, she said, go, just come back by this date. So together we flew off to Japan. Again, I realized how lucky that was in a pre-COVID world. And together we just wandered around Japan in a daze. We just needed to, we were grieving, he was grieving. We just needed to be somewhere where we didn't know anybody and we didn't know the place, and we could just walk around. It was really helpful for both of us. And, you know, he initially needed the support of the psychologist in a very male way. I think after about probably 5 sessions, he didn't feel like he needed to keep going. But what we agreed was that communication is key to anything in a relationship. So for us, we had an agreement that we could talk about anything, we could say anything about what had happened to Lily, about, you know, we could share things that we probably couldn't share with other people, deep, dark thoughts and feelings, and that we would always keep that communication up. And the way that we made sure we spoke was that we would walk together. And I think walking can be an easier way to get out all your thoughts and feelings, because you're not sitting staring at each other. So driving in the car can help. walking, you know, just a way that it can naturally come out. And we still do that. You know, we go for lots of walks together and we share, you know, what's happening in our day and, you know, thoughts and feelings. And for Will as well, he actually was one of the catalysts that helped me become braver in sharing our story, because he was quite open with people immediately after Lily died. And often I would wonder, why are you talking to that person about, you know, the fact that our child died? And then one day we're actually in Tasmania where we are here, and it was a Christmas, and he was loading a carton of beer into the car from the bottle shop and talking to this guy that he'd gone to school with years ago, telling him about Lily. And I was sitting in the car and I was a bit cross. I was like, why are you sharing this? Like, it's not the time. And he told this guy, and then the guy just started opening up to him and explained how he'd also had a baby that had died, that had a stillbirth child, how devastated he was. And it was this moment of beautiful connection. And that made me realize, I was like, oh, actually sharing about it helps other people share and helps this become less taboo.
Oh, yeah. And I think, you know, through your foundation, the Lily Calvert Foundation, I want to talk about that in a minute, and running your IG page, I just bet you get lots of people telling you their story. And talking about loss, how do you think that helps? And does it help everybody?
Yeah, so I definitely get people come to my page because they've been through a loss, or they've had a friend that's gone through a loss, or they've got a child that's been newly diagnosed at birth. And it definitely helps people if they can share, because they feel less alone. They feel less like the thoughts they're having are the wrong thoughts. And I think there's a lot of judgment that we put on ourselves in this space. And particularly if you've got a child that's been newly diagnosed with a disability, we all can think initially horrible thoughts because we wanted to have our perfect little baby. So sharing those stories and sharing stories of loss or sharing stories of diagnosis day can be really powerful, because it helps to normalize the feelings and it helps people feel less alone. On my website, actually this year, we started a storytelling platform called the Murmuring of 10 Million. And it is really just about getting people who have a story to tell to write a story about their child or their loss, and connecting them with other people. So if you go to that site, you can see stories, and at the bottom of each story is a way to connect to that person. So you might find, you know, if you lost a baby due to a rare pregnancy complication, our aim is that you might find somebody else who also has gone through that kind of loss, and you can connect and share. And similarly with a complex diagnosis for a child, it can be really helpful to have other people who are going through the same thing.
Because there's practical things that you need to know if that's what your story is, but there's the emotional side as well. Sometimes, you know, for me, I just like practical stories. Like, I like to know, okay, well, this has happened, so my next action is A and then B and then C and then D. And then after a time I think, oh, you know, actually I better tend to my emotional and mental health. So what sort of practical tips do you share with your audience, and what worked for you? And then we'll talk about the emotional tips.
I'm very much the same as you, Bridget, in that I am often very practical first, and in a crisis I'm like straight to what can we do now? There'll be time for falling apart later. But I do get a lot of people who have experienced a loss, or have a friend or a family member going through a loss. And again, it's why it's important to kind of listen to these sorts of podcasts, because you never know when someone around you might go through a loss. So I get a lot of people saying, oh, my best friend's baby just died. What can I do for her? How can I help her? How can I support her? And how can they, you know, what do they do right now? And a lot of it goes to what you've already shared on the podcast with Natural Grace, those sorts of questions. And I'm definitely going to point people towards those episodes as well. So there's that stuff that happens immediately after a baby has died. There's practical things you can do. And then a lot around, like, how do I talk to children? How do I tell my kids, you know, how do we share with our children and incorporate our baby that's died into our life? How do we do Christmas? How do we do these things? So there's practical elements and there's heart that's kind of wound into all of that. And I am in the process of pulling it all together into a book at the moment, an ebook or a, you know, because I get asked, you know, the same questions over and over again. And gifts as well. What can I buy? If you go to my Instagram page, there's a highlight now that's called Gifts for Loss, and it's just got lots of ideas about what you can buy for someone who's gone through a loss.
Yeah, because there's some beautiful books. Miles Apart is a beautiful book, isn't it? And also Heart Space is a journaling book by Amy. And all those things are just a beautiful gift to give to people. You just mentioned Christmas and, yeah, this will be released just before Christmas. So leading up to Christmas, what are you doing in your family that you could share that honours Lily yet lets the joy in for Jasper?
A couple of things first, I think, and particularly if it's your first Christmas after a loss, communication is key. And I think we all worry that our missing child is going to be forgotten at Christmas time. And the only way to really ensure that that doesn't happen is to communicate to your family what you want them to do and to be really upfront about it. Otherwise, you can be resentful and end up feeling sad, and that's just going to make you feel worse on the day. So get on the front foot, have those conversations, say, you know, we want to include Lily at Christmas time. We will be buying her a present. We would like a candle, you know, or some way that she could be included at the dining table. My family are pretty wonderful at this. So when you say, how will we be doing it this year? I'm like, well, they usually come up with some beautiful things. They will always include something at the table for Lily, whether it's just her name on a little place setting. We've got a beautiful candle that my sister-in-law bought, and it's, I'm going to say the wrong country. It's a European candle that has little angels. So the heat causes the angels at the top to kind of turn, and it's kind of silver.
Well, there you go. You'll have to put that on your Instagram now. Yeah.
And I bought a beautiful one last year from Mecca, actually. It was Diptyque, the Diptyque brand. And it's just like a Scandinavian kind of Christmas candle. But it twinkles as well. So it's got the heat of the candle causes the angels to turn, and it's got these beautiful chimes. That's what we use as Lily's place setting. And usually it will then have her name, whether it's a little, you know, a rock with her name on it or something as a place setting next to it. And they're always Lily's, you know, at Christmas time. Everybody remembers her in their speeches, and my family will usually have a photo frame of Lily as well with a candle next to it. So it can be as simple as that. It can be just listening to, you know, maybe a song or having that song playing, or a present under the tree, or acts of kindness as well can be really nice, you know, in lieu of a gift. Asking people to do things like donate blood or, you know, buy a gift for a charity or for the children's hospital can be a really nice way.
And how do you speak to Jasper about that?
So we have always been very honest and upfront with Jasper in an age-appropriate way, and I've got some resources on my website as well that I've worked on with some therapists on how to talk to children about loss. Jasper knows that Lily died and that she lives in the sky or the stars or in the clouds. You know, he kind of has different ways of saying that, and that she's all around him. And it's become so normal now that she's just a normal part of our life and our conversation. We have photos of her in our house. And I think you start that by just being honest with kids about what happened, and you have to be quite direct with the language you use, or they can, you know, become scared that they'll be lost. So if we say, you know, we lost the baby, they might actually think you lost the baby. So you have to use words like, you know, the baby died, but then, you know, also being aware you don't want your child to worry that they too will die. So, you know, the baby was very, very sick and the baby died. And Jasper comes back with questions, and it is confusing for him because he didn't ever get to meet his sister. But we just answer those questions and we just keep it really open. We don't, you know, there are no secrets. And we have some beautiful resources and books that talk about Lily, and lots of photos and photo books and that sort of thing.
Mm, how beautiful. We have that parenting ethos in our family too. Like, gosh, you live in a household with four boys and the dad is a gynecologist. We talk about everything, including around the kitchen table. But I didn't grow up that way. So I'm one of six. In fact, I'm one of seven. The second eldest in our family died when he was 21 days. And it was the unspoken grief that they had. And in fact, I think that was something that really fractured their relationship and got to the point where, you know, they did divorce when I was 19. I'm the last of the seven. So they stuck at it for a long time. We were moving once and I'm cleaning up dad's sort of desk and bureau. And I found all these bereavement cards that he had kept for 19 years. Oh, no, it would have been longer. I was 19 at the stage when I was doing it, so even longer than that. And I'm thinking, gosh, you know, this was just so unspoken. And now, you know, mum as an 84-year-old will talk about John a little bit, and now she wants to be buried in the same plot as John. But, you know, for such a long time, it just wasn't the generational thing to do.
That's right. And it's terribly sad because that during that kind of time, you know, the belief was it was more compassionate to whisk a baby away. So,
oh, my God, that's exactly what they did. Now that I talk to mum about that, they had to take him into hospital. He got an infection after a circumcision, and they took him into hospital, and basically that's the last they saw of him.
It's just so sad. And so there's a real loss in that important grieving phase. And I know in the episode with Natural Grace, you talk about, you know, having a cuddle cot and having that time with your baby. And I think it is so crucial in kind of kick-starting the way that you're going to approach your grief and helping to have time to say goodbye. And I really feel for people who had that happen to them. And my neighbour recently, oh, actually it was not long after Lily died, so it was a while ago, and she's in her 80s, and she was really confused one day about what had happened to our baby. And I'd avoided her probably for a year, you know, didn't want to have the conversation. And she thought I was a new neighbour. She was like, but didn't you have a baby called Lily? And I told her, you know, what had happened. And then she opened up and said that she'd also, similar to your parents, she had lost a baby. And she, you know, she said, I think about him every single day.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think with grief, it is really important to lean into it. Like, you have to acknowledge it. It hurts, but it's better than letting it fester away and pushing it away. And if you can kind of acknowledge that grief and, you know, dive deep into it, you can come out the other side.
Especially when you're actively parenting someone else. It definitely impacted my mum's parenting. She hadn't even probably to this day processed that. You know, you're very generous in talking about grief, but I'm just remembering a story that Carly Finlay, who's a disability advocate, was saying, that sometimes it's exhausting telling people all the time how to deal with, you know, talking to someone with a disability, or in your case, talking about grief and advising people on how they should talk to others who have gone through loss. Do you find it exhausting?
It's funny because I do most of it online. I actually find it, I don't find it exhausting. I find it quite energizing, and it gives me kind of a bit of purpose and meaning to kind of keeping Lily's memory alive. But I do think the magic of social media is that you can set healthy boundaries and disconnect. So, you know, if it's all too much, I have limits on how much time I'll spend online or on working on this, and I've got a full-time job as well. I can kind of disconnect from it. Whereas being in an in-person sort of situation is when it can get exhausting. And as time goes on, I pick and choose whether I tell my story to, you know, the person who I'm buying bread from who asks if Jasper is my only child. I choose my situations. And I think something that a lot of people who are grieving feel is that they feel guilty if someone asks, you know, is that your only child or is this your first pregnancy? They feel guilty if they don't answer honestly. They feel like, you know, I felt initially guilty that I was somehow, you know, deleting Lily's life by not saying, well, actually, no, I had another baby. The baby died. The baby was 10 months old. She was my firstborn. But what I have learned is that it is your choice. You know, it is my personal choice whether that person deserves to hear my story. And by choosing not to share it doesn't dishonor Lily in any way. And when I really got my head around that, it was better that I didn't need to tell the Uber driver, you know, because sometimes those people don't deserve, I mean, some Uber drivers are brilliant and they do deserve to hear it, but, you know, other people, you know, that you're not going to see again or that you suspect might not have a compassionate response, you don't need to tell them. I mean, having children is the other thing. Like, Jasper will often pipe up, and it does make me laugh sometimes, because he'll often pipe up, well, I have a sister. Oh, how old is she? She's in heaven. Will often really, you know, shut the conversation down with people. But I kind of think, well, if you can't handle what the answer is from a three-year-old, then you shouldn't really be asking the question.
I know. And a simple, like, how special is it to have a sister, you know, that's all around you, or whatever it is that, you know, reflecting back, that's probably not a bad point. Just reflect back what that three-year-old said. So you use the same language as what that three-year-old said and just reflect it back. All right. I want to talk a little bit about the Lily Calvert Foundation. What's your big plan there?
We set the Lily Calvert Fund up after Lily died. It was actually friends of ours wanted to do something and they came to us with that idea and we immediately latched onto it. The fund supports paediatric palliative care and also supports kind of opening up conversations around grief after loss. And at the moment we have a national program that is focused on music therapy. So Lily loved music therapy and it gave us the most incredible ways to communicate with us and kind of unlocked so much more than we'd realised in terms of what we were doing to ease pain and soothe her, but also communicate. So we want to share that gift with everyone in a palliative care in a paediatric palliative care program. So we've teamed up with a business called Tiny Tones Australia and they sell beautiful children's musical instruments. And at the moment we have music therapy kits that are distributed all across Australia in all the big hospitals and also paediatric palliative care hospices, so very special kids, Bear Cottage and Hummingbird House, and then all your major children's hospitals in the country stock them and they are given out by the palliative care teams or the music therapy teams to patients that come in or sent home. And the idea of them is to encourage exploring music therapy. So they get the instruments and they get a little kit and a little playlist that's been curated by Jimmy Rees. So it's really nice. And we've just started sending them to New Zealand too. So we're really focused on kind of building that program out at the moment. And yeah, we've got other kind of strategic priorities, but that's our major focus at the moment.
Gosh, how do you fit it all in, Priyanka? I think you're amazing.
Oh, I don't know. Sometimes just talking about it makes me feel anxious so much.
I can feel it. That's so funny. All right. So I just want to sort of ask you what your big dream in this space is. But before I do, I want to say that our stats are getting slightly better in terms of baby loss and death. From 1999, there's been a decrease in the rate of stillbirth and neonatal death from 5.7 to 3.3 deaths per 1,000. So it doesn't sound like we're making huge headway, but that is a huge headway. And that's getting better because we're getting better at detecting things such as low birth weight in babies. But from your perspective, what is your big dream in this space?
Two things, I think. First, and maybe it's not a big dream, but even a small dream is that I long for the day where a practitioner, when hearing about the loss of the baby, is able to just say, I'm so sorry that that happened to you. To have that education in place that it is okay to acknowledge it. And sadly, far too often, it's still something that gets ignored by a healthcare practitioner or, you know, someone who should be working with life and death and should be able to just acknowledge it. I'm so sorry for your loss, or, you know, tell me about your baby. What was her name? It doesn't have to be a big conversation, but just acknowledging it. And then I think also that not having to keep repeating that story. So how can we get to a place where we have a file so that one, you know, your OB might know about it, but you've got different midwives coming on shift and it can't be that hard, but that person doesn't have to sort of repeat the story each time. And the other kind of big dream, I guess, is for people who are going through a pregnancy after loss right now. I want you to know that it will be okay and that there is life after loss, there is hope after loss, and there can be a beautiful, rich, wonderful future ahead of you, even when it feels like you've hit rock bottom. So just keep going one footstep in front of the other and you will get there.
Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you. Thank you, Priyanka. And thank you so much for your time. And I wish you all the best in your baby-making quest.
Thank you. Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed.
Hopefully one day soon we'll be able to have another sibling for Jasper.
Yeah, how gorgeous. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.